Saudi Arabia says no to a seat at the table. Today, Friday, October 18th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. Saudi diplomats have spent years trying to get a seat on the UN Security Council. They got it yesterday, but turned the seat down. I asked one veteran UN watcher on the odds that the kingdom might reconsider.
I wouldn't bet a month's pay on it, but maybe, you know, I'd bet like $5 or $10 that, yeah, it would.
The Saudis say they're upset about the UN's policy on Syria. We speak to a British surgeon who's just back from 5 weeks helping to heal the wounded in Syria.
All we did was to operate and sleep, operate and sleep. There was no normal sleep time.
And later, a German musician tells us about his Soul Train.
Parliament Funkadelic stuff, then George Clinton, Bootsy, like James Brown and all this stuff.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks, but no thanks. That's what Saudi Arabia said today to the United Nations Security Council. The Saudis were elected by other nations at the UN to one of the council's 10 rotating non-permanent seats. Normally, that's a golden opportunity for a nation like Saudi Arabia to raise its diplomatic profile, but the oil-rich kingdom instead rejected the seat. It issued a scathing statement blasting the Security Council for failing in its duty to protect the world's peace. The decision has a lot of observers scratching their heads. Colm Lynch covers the UN for foreignpolicy.com. Easy question, Colm. What is going on here?
Easy question, not an easy answer. I guess it sort of reflects a certain frustration and anxiety by the Saudis over the lack of action in Syria. The Saudis have been supporting militarily and politically and diplomatically the Syrian opposition. They've been looking and trying to put pressure to remove President Assad from power. And events are not going in their direction at the UN. And I think they have been showing frustration on a number of fronts. Their foreign minister in September had planned to address the UN General Assembly and decided not to do it at the last moment. That was almost unprecedented. And this is, you know, another nearly unprecedented act.
So they're just kind of throwing a fit then?
You know, there's a real question. There hasn't been a formal, I mean, the foreign ministry sent out a statement saying that they were going to do this. They haven't formally, informed the United Nations. And I think there's probably plenty of room for them to backstep on that. But nevertheless, it's, you know, extremely interesting. I mean, it's a long history with nobody doing this. I mean, there's the one case, the famous case of the Soviet Union back in 1950, boycotting Security Council meetings because of anger over the failure of the council to recognize Red China. Ukraine apparently boycotted some meetings back in 1948, but I don't think we have any other examples of it since then.
Well, tell me what the official reasons are for the Saudis not taking on the seat, and are those reasons credible?
Well, they are credible in the sense that, you know, the Saudis kind of expressed a long-standing critique of the Security Council, that it operates under double standards, that it's, you know, not democratic, and this is true.
Colm, undemocratic because, what, well, 5 of 15 members control everything?
Because 5 of 15 members control everything, and they operate under their own rules. There is no other body or institution that can challenge their decisions. They can make mistakes, and if they make mistakes, they don't have to fix them.
Colm, I wonder if this could be seen as kind of a poke in the eye to America, what Saudi has done.
I think it's a real possibility. I mean, Saudis have had a lot of issues of concern with the Americans and with the course of American diplomacy over the last several months. The Saudis are very supportive of the military government in Egypt. The U.S. has been very cool towards the government. The Americans just worked out a sort of a deal with Russia over the elimination of chemical weapons in Syria. The Saudis are not crazy about that because it sort of softened the previous approach, moving towards applying more military pressure. They favored an attack on the government to try and move towards unseating President Assad. And the U.S. is now in diplomatic negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. Iran is Saudi Arabia's main regional rival, and they see this kind of rapprochement is troubling. So there's a lot of issues where Saudi Arabia is in sort of confrontation with the Americans.
So, Colm Lynch, next time we speak with you, will Saudi Arabia actually be on the Security Council, or won't they?
I wouldn't bet a month's pay on it, but maybe, you know, I'd bet like $5 or $10 that, yeah, it would.
Okay, deal. Colm Lynch covers the United Nations for foreignpolicy.com. Colm, thank you as always.
All right, thanks for having me.
The fighting in Syria continues, relentless day after day, and every day there are casualties. Doctors are in high demand close to the front lines, but there aren't enough of them. Which brings us to David Knott. He's a vascular surgeon from London, but for a few weeks each year, he travels to some of the most dangerous places in the world to offer medical help. And he's just recently returned from Syria. He doesn't want us to say where he was, only that it was a northern town on the front lines.
I was only there for 5 weeks, and 5 weeks went by like 2 days because it was just so full on. I was working 18 hours a day, sometimes having 4 hours sleep a night. The sort of surgery that you do is very difficult. And for the surgeons that are there, I mean, they've been there for, you know, 2 years now, and they're depressed, they're fed up. And of course, the problem is that there was 5,000 doctors in the town where I was before the war started. And now there's 36 left. And of the 36 left, they're absolutely exhausted. All we did was to operate and sleep, operate and sleep. And you slept at various hours of the day. There was no sleep time, that normal sleep time. You just worked and slept, worked and slept. And for me, you know, I was exhausted. And for them, though, I mean, they need help. Big time.
Knott says he dealt with the results of airstrikes now and again, but most of the wounds he and the other doctors dealt with every day, he says, were from sniper fire directed at civilians.
I'm sure that the snipers were having a game, and it was a game that some days we would have many neck wounds, some days we would have only groin wounds, some days we would have only chest wounds. And to me, that seemed that, you know, people were being targeted, various parts of the anatomy were being targeted. And I was asking this question when I was there, and in fact, I was told that there are 72 snipers in the city at the moment who are picking people off. And it's a game, and they're getting packets of cigarettes and things for targeting as many people in the anatomical region as they can. Compared to, I mean, I've been doing this job for 20 years or so now, so every year I go off somewhere and have been in various conflicts and catastrophe zones, and lots of civilians are wounded in crossfires in very many conflicts, but here it's not crossfire, it's actually direct fire, and the civilians are actually the people that are targeted, and that to me was the most shocking part of this.
I imagine as a surgeon in London, you have all the latest equipment to deal with injuries like this. Not that you'd likely see injuries like this, but what are the sorts of conditions you're working in Syria?
Well, we have no investigatory tools, for example, so there's no CT scanners, MRI scanners. There's nothing apart from routine X-rays. However, most of the people that were injured were bleeding to death, basically. And so it's not a big problem to operate on these patients immediately because you'd sort of know the area which has been targeted. So, for example, if the abdomen was targeted and somebody was hemorrhaging, then you'd have to really, you had no time for a CT scan. Even in the UK or America, you'd still have no time for a CT scan. They have to be rushed into theatre. And so it wasn't really, really necessary to have all the major equipment that you'd have in the major trauma centres, either in the UK or the States. So if somebody came in with a massive gunshot wound, they went straight into the operating theatre and had either the blood vessel or the bleeding stopped immediately. They've been doing this now for a year or so, and they've really organised their trauma system very well.
And foreign doctors like David Knott are not the only ones lending a hand. Knott says there's a group of Syrian expat doctors here in the U.S. who are consulting with their colleagues back home via Skype.
It's telemedicine at its ultimate, to be honest. And in fact, patients can have their operation and can be advised if the surgeon who's doing it isn't all that au fait with what he's doing, can be advised over a Skype call. So things are moving on nicely there, to be honest with you. And there's an awful lot of help given from the Syrian American Medical Society, who are doing a great job, I must say.
David, two questions. One is, why do you keep doing this every year? And I guess the other side of that question is, why don't you bring more of your friends?
Well, that's a good question. Both are good questions. I can't tell you the reason why I do this every year. It's something I started 20 years ago. I went to Sarajevo during the height of the siege in Sarajevo, and it was just a light went on in my head, basically, to try and help people in the most dire situations. And, if I could, I would do it all the time, but I have teams here that I have to work with and train. And I try and stimulate people to go and do this sort of work. But it is difficult work. It is difficult, and it requires technical expertise, because, you know, you can't send in people that actually can't do the operating. You need people to go in that will heal people rather than make them worse. And the potential for making people worse is quite high. And most of the patients that we operated on in Syria, it was life and death. I would say 99% was life and death. So that if you weren't there and you didn't operate on them, that patient would die.
David, I imagine it's something of a tough sell to get doctors to go. They watch the news, they see the damage to these cities. And not only that, we should point out, it isn't just being in a city that's problematic. It's getting in and out. That's dangerous, too. I have to imagine the government isn't real pleased with your presence.
Well, you're quite right, in fact. And of course, you know, first of all, the regime side don't want you there. They don't want people there. And then secondly, as you go in, it is very, very dangerous, because you've got lots of factions as well. To be honest with you, the Free Syrian Army are a good group of people. It's unfortunately, I have to say, that the other factions that are there, the fundamentalists, do make your life very worrisome. And you do feel that you do run the gauntlet of being a non-Muslim person, for non-Syrian going in, because you're there to try and help on a humanitarian side. And you do run the gauntlet of going through many checkpoints with these sort of people.
Now, David, you're British. You've got that whole stiff upper lip thing and all, but I have to imagine this takes a toll on one's psyche, especially, you know, you go to the area for 5 weeks, you come back to London, it's a completely different world.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there is no doubt that, you know, I do feel that, you know, I've come back to work and I'm in the operating theatre today, and it's a totally different planet to where I was a week or so ago. And it does take me, it always takes me 2 or 3 months to really get back to some sort of normality. And it is extremely stressful. No doubt about it. I don't suffer from flashbacks and things like that, really, but I do realise that I'm just not running on all four cylinders at the moment. And it always takes me a couple of months to get over something like this.
Surgeon David Knott, a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. David Knott spoke with us from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London. He was recently in Syria for 5 weeks, helping to treat the wounded. There are lots of new ways to find the world. There's our new digital home, of course, PRI.org. Another great way is with the Flipboard app. Think radio becomes a magazine whose pages you can actually flip through and at the same time hear all the voices you know from the world. It's pretty cool, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. You can find that at flipboard.com/the world. And you are listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. There are, as we know, some things you shouldn't talk about at a party. Religion, politics, and soccer? Yeah, in Egypt, soccer and politics are proving a volatile mix. Egypt's national soccer team, the Pharaohs, got clobbered this week in Ghana trying to qualify for the World Cup. Supporters of ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and his opponents each accused the other side of bringing the team down. And the team's American coach, Bob Bradley, once considered something of a national savior, is now being pilloried. Matt Bradley, no relation, is Cairo correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He says that game against Ghana was painful for the Egyptians.
I mean, what we saw in the game was really a very humiliating rout. It was a 6-1 defeat for Egypt. A lot of them, you know, we heard things like it looked as though they had never played soccer in their lives, and that only Mohamed Abu Traoré, who is the hero of the Egyptian team, showed any wherewithal playing a world-class team like Ghana's. And a lot of the focus of the blame here in Egypt has gone on to Coach Bradley himself. Whether his defensive strategy was enough, obviously, if Ghana was able to score 6 points against Egypt, a lot of anger came out against Bob Bradley. He was kind of the lost savior.
Egypt could have won this game, right? The teams were not that lopsided.
No, and in fact, Egypt was going into the match with an undefeated record up until now. So Egypt was in a very, very good position. And in fact, Egyptians were very grateful to Bob Bradley for really leading the team and improving the team, despite political problems, delays, and street violence throughout Cairo that really just dragged on the team. Egypt was in a very good standing when the game started. The whole country really came to a standstill just to see this moment that was thought to be the moment of glory for Egypt after 25 years of sporting failure. And it was very surprising to have 6-1 Ghana winning.
Some see politics in Egypt's lone goal in the game in the 6-1 match because it was scored by a player that is openly a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Abu Traoré.
That's right. Mohamed Abu Traoré is an openly supportive of Islamists and Islamism. We have to understand that right now the political climate is so poisonous that it would be at great considerable risk for Mr. Abu Traoré to say something publicly in favor of Mohamed Morsi or in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. But he is known to have those sympathies.
Is there any chance the Pharaohs can bounce back from this loss and still make it into the World Cup?
When they play Ghana again on November 19th, and it's not exactly clear where that game will be played because of the safety risks here in Cairo, in order for Egypt to qualify, it would have to make something along the order of a 5-1 or 6-1, something around the points Ghana scored against Egypt. So that would be extremely difficult.
Coach Bradley, from what I understand, is at risk of getting fired, right?
The Egyptian Football Association is going to be meeting on Monday to determine Bradley's fate. But some of the early word that we've been seeing that Bradley's $366,000 clause in his contract that prevents him from being terminated early, this is probably going to protect him. But it's yet to be seen whether Bradley will be taking the reins and coaching on November 19th, when Ghana is likely to come to Cairo and play Egypt once again for the second qualifying round. So Egypt does need some luck right now. That's what this country is yearning for. They would really like to hear some good news after nearly 3 years of economic collapse and political infighting.
The Wall Street Journal's Matt Bradley, thank you for speaking with us from Cairo.
Thank you.
Staying with the sports theme, this weekend fans of college football team Clemson will try to beat a record set less than a week ago by Chiefs fans in Kansas City. You probably had to be there to get the full effect, but this is what it sounded like on the CBS broadcast.
And they have just been given word that they have set the record. Loudest crowd ever. In an open-air stadium, we'll get the official...
Congratulations, Kansas. A deafening crowd like that is often called the 12th man in football. That's the home field advantage. And it's not just players who thrive on it. We viewers need to hear it, too. The more crucial the contest, the louder the noise needs to be. and you only really get a sense of just how much we all crave that sound when it's not there. Here's the world's language editor, Patrick Cox.
Last May, at the climax of the Swiss soccer season, two teams with a fierce rivalry, Grasshoppers and FC Zurich, played each other. Swiss TV station SRF broadcast the highlights. There was just one problem with this. The crowd wasn't actually there. The fans of both teams were staging a protest outside the stadium. They only went inside later on in the game. The TV station said they wanted to make the show, quote, as attractive as possible, so they added fake crowd sounds. They apologized later, but you can see where they were coming from. I mean, what kind of enjoyment is there in watching a big game to this kind of soundtrack? Yep, bit of a downer. Now, usually when games are played behind closed doors, it's a punishment for some act of hooliganism. But it's rare that more than one or two teams are punished. That did happen in Tunisia this year. The country is still in post-revolutionary turmoil, and there have been political riots at soccer games. So nearly all professional games have been played in empty stadiums. These are recordings of the fans of Tunisian team Harman Leaf. An ad agency called Ogilvy and Mather took these recordings and, well, let's hear from creative director Nicolas Coron.
We created an app that connected mobile phones and internet to big loudspeakers. There were 40 speakers inside the stadium.
So that fans far from the stadium, who were watching the game on TV, they could use the app to show their appreciation for their team.
Basically, the users just had to tap on sound icons, and a simple tap was instantly transformed into a powerful support, because the more you tapped on the icon, the louder it was in the stadium.
It got really loud for Harman Leaf's crunch game of the season. 93,000 fans used the app in that game, their finger taps roaring their team on, as it turned out, to victory. The conventional fan capacity of the stadium is only 12,000. Now, this all sounds super cool, this crowdsourcing of crowds. But the app, it's called the 12th Man, it does have its limits. For one thing, it doesn't have an icon for booing or heckling or personal insults, all beloved by soccer fans. And let's face it, as much as the players may have enjoyed the noise, it was coming out of big boxes. You can't beat a real crowd. Just listen to this. You'll have to forgive the choice. I'm a Brit. This is double Olympic gold winner Mo Farah describing the climax to the 5,000 metres in last year's London Games.
Winning one gold and then coming back for the second one was incredible. The crowd was just amazing. There's no word to describe it. The crowd gave me extra gear, gave me that lift. They were almost like pushing me to the line. And as I was getting closer to the line, got louder and louder. It was just amazing, and I remember saying, crossing that line and thinking, wow, I did it.
Try recreating that on a smartphone. For the world, I'm Patrick Cox.
For more stories on crowds, chants, and language, check out our podcast, The World in Words. You can find it at pri.org/language. You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Coming up, a journalist and her colleagues leave Kabul for a trip on Afghanistan's infamous Highway 1.
We went deeper into the life of the people and talked to them. We heard about the past, about the present, and about the hopes for the future.
Plus, funky soul music from Munich.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. More than 8 million people living in the U.S. have a green card. These are legal permanent residents who, after a waiting period, are eligible to become U.S. citizens. But less than 38% actually do. That's low when compared to some other nations. Our neighbor to the north, Canada, for example, has a naturalization rate of 89%. The world's Nina Porzucki has the final story in our series this week about citizenship. She explores why some people who could become American citizens decide not to.
Angel Riono has lived in the U.S. as a legal permanent resident for more than a decade. She studied here, married an American, and has no intention of moving back to her homeland, Taiwan.
I am, for the most part, more American than I am Taiwanese.
Still, when it comes to taking the next step and becoming a U.S. citizen, she's been on the fence.
There was one point where I just actually considered never getting my citizenship when George W. Bush was in office. No way. But nowadays, I feel much more inclined to apply for my citizenship.
So leaning towards citizenship, but still undecided. Full disclosure, I know Angel Riono from high school, when her name was Angel Chang. She was one of the smart kids. She applied for early admission to Smith College, and she was political, hanging out with the kids sporting lefty buttons and Che t-shirts. But what I didn't know about Angel was that she was undocumented. Turns out she didn't really know herself until she was 17, and she told her parents that she'd just received a full ride to Smith.
I wasn't expecting them to have a disturbed look and a worried look on their face. And that was when they told me that I can't receive the scholarship and I cannot go to Smith because I don't have documents. I would have to pay full tuition without aid. There was no way I could go.
That moment at 17 changed her life. Angel didn't go to Smith. Instead, at 18, she married her high school sweetheart and began the green card process on her own.
I filed all by myself, no lawyer, and waited in line, went to all the meetings, and attended the interviews. It was all me.
The process left a bitter taste in her mouth. And Angel is far from alone, says Joanne Gottesman, a professor of immigration law at Rutgers University in Camden.
There is a little bit of a fear of the immigration process, you know, because these are people who went through it to get their green cards, and that, you know, they realize how complicated the bureaucracy is and how daunting the paperwork can be. And so there was a little bit of a sense of fear, too.
The paperwork can be intimidating, beginning with the N-400 form. It literally helps determine one of the requirements needed to become a citizen.
You also need to have good moral character.
So how do you judge moral character?
It's asking everything from, you know, have you ever had a parking ticket? You know, have you ever been a prostitute? I believe is one of the questions.
Randy Shemelsky coordinates Citizenship Rutgers, a free service in New Jersey that helps immigrants fill out the N-400. Been a member of the Communist Party or aligned with the Nazi regime in Germany? Been a habitual drunkard? Yes, that's all on the form. But, says immigration lawyer Joanne Gottesman, even after helping many, many people fill out the form,
we found that even at the end of the day, after having completed their paperwork, they simply weren't filing because they couldn't afford the cost.
It costs $680 just to file the form. That's about 2 weeks of minimum wage work in some states. And that's not including any lawyer fees. But for Angel, the fees or ticking a box about her political affiliations isn't really what's keeping her from going for citizenship. It's pegged to her experience navigating the immigration system and to one single day nearly a decade ago when she was waiting in yet another line to get her green card. She watched as a family standing next to her was told to go back home.
And then explain to them, we lost your file. You just have to file all the papers over again. I keep thinking back to that family. That alone is a big deterrent. It's very emotional.
An emotional, expensive, bureaucratic nightmare. Still, Angel says, she will get around to it, just when the timing feels right. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucki.
Yesterday, we spoke about citizenship with Mike Gwaltney, who teaches 11th grade history at a school in Oregon. He mentioned that his students recently created their own alternative to the U.S. citizenship test. One of the students' questions, why did Americans reject the idea of a monarchy? That's a good one. You can leave your own answer at PRI.org. And speaking of a monarchy, the United Kingdom has a controversial pilot program designed to get illegal immigrants to go home. It includes a text message that recently went out to 50,000 people. It read, "Message from the UK Border Agency. Our records show you may not have leave to remain in the UK. Please contact us to discuss your case." It was intended for undocumented immigrants, but civil rights campaigner Suresh Grover says he got that text, and he's been living legally in Britain for decades. He says at least he knows his rights.
But I think there are lots of people who would be getting this text who do not understand the law. It creates a sense of fear and anxiety, and in that context, these texts should be stopped.
A lot of people apparently agree. The British government says it's now assessing the results of that text. It's also reviewing another program it piloted this summer. That one placed ads on vans, urging illegal immigrants to go home. The small island nation of Bahrain was one of those places convulsed by protests during the Arab Spring. Now Bahrain isn't in the news very much, but that doesn't mean the protests that started in 2011 are over. In fact, they've continued all along. That's according to Elizabeth Dickinson, a journalist based in Abu Dhabi. She has a new e-book called Who Shot Ahmed? It was published by a group called the Development and Aid World News Service, DAWNS. Dickinson tells the story of Ahmed Ismail Hassan al-Samadi, a young man who was shot and killed while he videotaped a protest in 2012.
Well, Ahmed was sort of the typical young man who was really energized by everything that started happening with the Arab Spring. Ahmed was a store clerk during the day, so he was really just sort of the average kid the average kid that you know from the neighborhood. One of his passions was photography, and when the uprising first started, he saw what happened in Egypt, he saw what happened in Tunisia, and realized that photography, that video, was going to be so important in organizing and really bringing people together for these sorts of demonstrations. So he really jumped in, and from almost day one of the protests, he really saw it as his mission to record what was happening in Bahrain.
And he is a Shiite living in a Sunni-dominated country, right? And that makes a difference.
So he is a member of the Shiite community, and the majority, actually, of Bahrain is Shiite. It's not a large majority. It's about 60-40. But the country is ruled by Sunni leaders, and for a long time there have been tensions over whether there is discrimination on the kingdom. So, for example, you know, if government is giving jobs to members of the Shiite community, if, you know, Shiites are living in certain areas that maybe aren't as well serviced with things like hospitals and electricity, things like this.
Now, there are, as you suggested, lots of young men who are out on the streets demonstrating against the government. Why Ahmed's story? What drew you to him?
Well, during one of my visits to Bahrain, in the sort of early days of the uprising, if you remember, a lot of the sort of momentum of the protests would go up and down depending on what was happening, and frankly, whether or not there were casualties. And I happened to arrive the day after Ahmed died, and everyone was talking about Ahmed's death. I think it wasn't just because he had been the most recent person to die, but it was also because everyone felt like they could relate to him. He was so young. He was so hopeful. By all accounts, he was a very quiet, normal boy. And the fact that he got caught up in this violence really touched people personally. For me, I went and was able to talk to Ahmed's family the day after he died. I witnessed and saw very close personally how they were mourning and just how difficult it was for his sisters, his brothers. And as I was leaving, Ahmed's sister took my hand and she said to me with the voice that I can't forget, she said, "I want to see you again." I didn't forget that.
Now, in one part of your ebook, you say Bahrain is the Middle East's forgotten revolution. Is it still going on there? Has it been sort of snuffed out by the government? Where do things stand?
Well, this is one of the amazing things about Bahrain that continues to amaze me every single day that I cover it, is that if you go to Bahrain any day of the week, you will find a protest in at least one of the villages that's going on. So the persistence of this uprising is really, it's really jarring, and it's really surprising for an outsider to see that despite the fact that there's very little international attention, there's no one watching, you know, these protests continue to go on.
Now, what about Ahmed's family? They've lost a son now. Do they think about joining protests, or has this driven them away?
As I've gone back to visit Ahmed's family over the months, it's been amazing to see how much it has affected them. Before Ahmed died, members of his family, so for example, his father would very rarely go to protests. This was sort of an average family, really not very politicized. After Ahmed's death, all of that seemed to change. And in many ways, Ahmed was sort of kept alive by members of his family. So his father took up his filming. Now, almost every week, at least at one of the protests, you'll see Ahmed's father carrying his son's camera, filming the protest, carrying on exactly the way that Ahmed did. Meanwhile, other members of his family have sort of picked up other parts of Ahmed's work. Some of them are active online. Some of them write, you know, and sort of do community organizing. Basically, they've become stronger members of the opposition because of what happened to their son than they ever would have been before.
Reporter Elizabeth Dickinson, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You can read excerpts of the book Who Shot Ahmed at PRI.org. There's nothing like a road trip to get the flavor of a country, but in Afghanistan, the options for driving cross-country can be limited, and they could get you killed. There is just one highway which connects 16 of the country's 34 provinces, Highway 1, and even that is incomplete and in disrepair, leaving aside the risk of Taliban ambushes. Reporters from BBC's Afghan service have launched a major series covering the length of Highway 1 and seeing what it can tell us about the state of Afghanistan now and in the future. Mina Bakhtash is the BBC's Kabul Bureau editor. Mina, started it off, if you would, by just telling us about the project and why you got it going.
First of all, you put it so well. You know, looking at the map, it feels so easy to drive along this road. But as every aspect of life in Afghanistan, the reality is completely different. In every corner of this road, there are hundreds of sub-corners hidden. Telling the story of the Ring Road will be telling the story of Afghanistan.
Highway 1, or the Ring Road, as you say, existed for decades, right?
Exactly. This road came to existence in August 1961. And different countries were actually competing with each other. Japanese were here, Saudis were here, Soviets were here, and Americans were here. And then in 2003, Americans promised President Karzai that they will rebuild that piece of the road within a year. And they did it. That
From was Kandahar a personal to Kabul.
Promise. Yes, we call it KK, Kabul Kandahar.
That's interesting because when I was in Kabul, that was kind of referred to as the death road. Kabul to Kandahar was not a trip a Western journalist would make.
To be honest, even today you can't make that trip. And we had to just cover that piece of road by talking to people who can make that trip.
Mina, tell us what the highway is like as a road. You've been to England, you've been to the West, you've seen what highways are there. We're calling this a highway, but it's not.
Yeah, it's a two-lane highway with no other additional lanes and service stations, non-existing. Yes, in some parts, there are some sorts of restaurants on the side of the road. There are still problems, although it has been built so many times, but the quality of work is not good. So in every winter, at the end of every winter, they have to go back and repair it again and again.
Did you learn anything from this series that you didn't know from the reporters who traveled the road?
First of all, we learned how difficult it is to travel around Afghanistan. But actually, traveling on this road, we went deeper into the life of the people and talked to them, I mean, to families. You know, we heard about the past, about the present, and about the hopes for the future. If it would have been peaceful, you could have gone through different cultures, different languages, different communities traveling on that road. You know, because almost 65-70% of Afghan population is living just within 50 kilometers of this ring road. So it is a very sort of live road. And if it would have been peaceful and properly rebuilt, it would have been had an immense impact on the livelihood of Afghan people and also for unleashing economic growth in this country.
The BBC's Mina Bakhtash, she helped put together a special project from Kabul called Life Along Highway 1. Mina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Want a glimpse of life along Afghanistan's Highway 1? Mina sent us some amazing photos at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. Coming back to where we started the show today, Saudi Arabia. We have a story about a guy who moonlights in a really unusual way. His name is Abdul Nasser Gharib, and he's a contemporary artist who shows his work in galleries all over the world. But he's also a lieutenant colonel in the Saudi army. Gharib is 40, and he grew up in what was a small agricultural town. So when he started to do his artwork there, he got some strange reactions, especially for a performance piece that he did, where he wrapped himself and a tree in a giant sheet of plastic.
I'm coming from a tribe, and the people there, it's a small village, and everybody knows. And the phone calls start between them, and what's this guy doing? And then I'm being in the army, so it was a little bit complicated. And the people start to come immediately. They just come to me. The whole city just, in the beginning, they thought I'm crazy. And then I start to tell them, guys, there is an issue here.
And that issue was an environmental one. Like much of his artwork, the piece touched on problems that Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world are now facing. Gharib says that art can be a way to talk about things in a conservative country where it's not comfortable to speak about politics.
You know, through the newspaper or the official channel, you cannot say what you want sometimes. But through the art, you have a kind of exit.
But Gharib's art can be political. In 2008, he was exhibiting a piece in London that featured an image of one of the planes hitting the Twin Towers. It's an extremely sensitive issue for the Saudi government, since most of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi citizens. So when some Saudi officials saw the exhibition in London, they asked him to withdraw the piece. Gharib refused, but he did agree to change it. He took out the imagery of the plane, though he didn't want to. Gharib now has a new show up in London through early November. In this interview with the BBC, he concedes that sometimes it's easier to show his artwork outside his home country.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a strategy. You know, you can, you know, I learned from the army a lot. I know that I should do my career relying on long term, and just, you know, my main mission is to protect my people and to let them think. And I figure it out. I know what's the main problem. The main problem, the people are not thinking. So I should encourage them to think.
Gharib says he doesn't see any conflict between being an artist and a military man. In fact, he says they complement one another. There's a lot of great music in this country that we don't talk a lot about on this program because, well, this is The World, and we focus a lot on non-American music. The World's Marco Werman, who's usually in this chair, has been looking for ways to talk about a little record label in New York City, and it seems he's found his chance. Marco?
Aaron, that's because Daptone Records has released its first foreign act. That is, if you don't count the late Amy Winehouse, Daptone's stellar house band, the Dap Kings, was her backing section. No, this is something else.
It came over me.
This is the Poets of Rhythm. Sadly, they're not together anymore, but hey, they're German. They're from Munich. When I first heard this album, The Poets of Rhythm, Anthology 1992-2003, all I could do was riff in my head on that monologue from The Commitments, you know, about a white soul band in Dublin, except it just feels weird in a German context. You know, the Germans are the blacks of Europe, and the Munichers are the blacks of Germany, and the Northside Munichers are the blacks of Munich.
So say it once, say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud.
That's Jimmy Rabbit from The Commitments. J.J. Whitefield, are you the Jimmy Rabbit of Munich then?
No, definitely not, no.
He wouldn't even bite. But then again, J.J. Whitefield, or rather Jan Weissenfeld, takes his soul music seriously. Yeah, Whitefield is a literal translation of Weissenfeld, which is not a good name for a soul man. J.J. Whitefield's first encounter with black music in Germany? Probably on the radio, he says.
After the war, we had like the you know, the American GIs like stationed in Munich, and they had their own radio station and they had clubs and stuff like this. So there was always like a culture brought from the States to Germany in terms of black music. But like consciously, I remember like someone gave me a tape of Grandmaster Flash in like 82 or something like this. So that was the first contact with black music.
Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five warranted deeper investigation. JJ started binging on soul, starting with the early 80s and working his way backwards.
To like discover the back catalog, like all Parliament Funkadelic stuff, then George Clinton, Bootsy, like I made the connection, James Brown and all this stuff. Then the Meters went deeper and deeper. I started playing school dances, DJing, therefore buying more and more records, the rare funk 45 stuff.
Until the only thing left to do was to make the music himself. Fortunately, J.J. Whitefield met another obsessive German soul man, Bo Baral, in high school. Bo, a vocalist, could mimic James Brown, and they created a band, with a horn section, of course, called themselves the Poets of Rhythm, and they figured out how to make music like this. Poets of Rhythm's new anthology covers their active years. It features 18 tracks. Three of them are titled North Carolina, South Carolina, and Augusta, GA. In 1990, JJ and Bo traveled from Germany on their first pilgrimage to New Orleans to dig deeper into funk outfits like the Meters. They boarded a Greyhound in New York and set off on a 36-hour bus ride, seeing a side of the U.S. they didn't know.
North Carolina, then South Carolina, then Georgia. Passing these states and like seeing the difference and like the people that got on and off the bus and stuff like this, basically it was the inspiration. So when we came back home, we just remembered this bus trip and then wrote songs about it. I look out to the countryside. It can only be South Carolina, 'cause my heart, yeah, my heart belongs to South Carolina.
If you didn't know better, you'd swear this German's heart really is in South Carolina. Maybe it is. So, Aaron, now that you know the backstory, let it go. You all just need to listen to Germany's Poets of Rhythm on Daptone Records as one of the best soul bands you've never heard of from, for all intents and purposes, South Carolina. Just like my band that wants to be in South Carolina.
Thank you, Marco. The man himself will be back here in the booth on Monday. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Aaron Schachter, at World Aaron. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great weekend. Yeah, yeah.
Public Radio International.